Welcome to Cinema Chop Shop. Watch, chop, retrofit.
It's like, hey, take a selfie.
The fact that you were in LA, the most, like, you know, plastic of places without a cell phone is kind of cool.
No, I actually, that made it a little bit more enjoyable. I enjoyed my week without a phone, frankly. Once I got over the panic and anxiety and had reached out to the people who would need to contact me immediately and told them how to contact me, I was like, you know what? Turned out well.
But this is not a Luddite podcast. This is Cinema Chop Shop. Welcome back. And I'd like to welcome my guests, Todd. Mm-hmm. Hollywood Todd.
Yep.
And Joey Poole.
Hello.
And I'm your host, Sean. Unfortunately, Travis could not be with us tonight. All right. This week, we're talking about dynamic duo directors, the Triple D's. This was inspired by Joey's idea quite a while back. You said, let's do a Powell and Pressburger episode. Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking that for people who may not know Powell and Pressburger and their body of work, which is tremendous, other directorial duos and that seem to work well together or choose to work well together, be they brothers, you know, like some of the ones we're going to discuss today, or just guys who just get paired up by the studio and they just work well together or what have you. So we're going to kind of dive into that and talk about some of the those duos as well as the works that they've done and what makes them kind of stand apart. What makes them better together versus flying solo, which I've got a funny quote from one
so
of mine.
So better together.
So without further ado, we're just going to dive right in. And Joey, you're going to lead things off with the OG inspiration.
So, Powell and Pressburger, Michael Powell, Emmerich Pressburger. I think we mangled those names last week.
Yeah, we kind of stumbled over them.
Emmerich! Yeah. AKA the Archers. After their production company, there's a little, what do you call those? Like a bumper, I guess?
Yes, it's little title cards for the production houses.
Mm-hmm. They share writer, director, producer credits for most of their films. Pressburger was kind of thought of in some circles as Powell's script writer, but to his credit, Powell always said that the tag team was a little bit more equanimous. Pressburger usually would come up with original stories and then write first drafts of the script, and they would bandy them back and forth. He did most of what would be called production, especially when it came to music. He had a background as a musician. Powell would do most of what we would call direction and also do co-writing, but they more or less evenly split credits on all of those things. And just like you were mentioning earlier, a huge filmography. They have 24, I think, films together, and a couple individual ones as well. Big string of British movies. The thing that strikes me about Powell and Pressburger, and I thought about this when I was thinking about one of the movies that I'm talking about a little bit here later, I think that they're kind of like the Velvet Underground of big mid-century directors, because your average movie fan, there's no name recognition with that. But if you talk to somebody who's a real film nerd, then they're all, you know, everybody is in.
How did the two get together?
They were working on a movie by a British, actually Hungarian immigrant British director named Alexander Korda in the 30s. Powell himself was an established director dating back to the silent era. And they hit it off and started working together. Made most of their films together. They had a manifesto. There's an Archer's manifesto that I found.
oh, arrogant.
Yeah, it is pretty arrogant, but I won't read the entire thing to you. You can find it in several places online. But a couple of highlights. We owe allegiance to nobody except the financial interests which provide our money, and to them, the sole responsibility of ensuring them a profit, not a loss. That's the very first thing on the manifesto is like.
what I find interesting about that manifesto is a contrast to the Dog May 95 mm-hmm. manifesto, which is essentially the opposite aesthetically of their manifesto.
Very, very much so.
No unnatural lighting, for example, in the Dog May 95. The if people don't know, we're talking about Lars von Trier and some Scandinavian directors came up with Dog May 95, which you can Google, and they had all these rules for movies, which were mostly like cheaping, you know, making them as cheap as possible.
Very austere approach to filmmaking.
No sets, no lighting, ambient sound. So that was interesting. The very first thing in the manifesto is, hey, we realize that we're artists, but we're in this to make money, so we have to make money. And then later on, no artist believes in escapism, which I found interesting because their films are arguably, on the surface, very escapist for reasons that we'll talk about later. We secretly believe that no audience does. We have proved, at any rate, that they will pay to see the truth for other reasons than her nakedness. So, yeah, a little bit hoity-toity, but, you know, I respect the artistic vision and the chutzpah of having a manifesto.
They want to be known that they're artists.
Well, and it's reflected
in
the work.
They're not Hollywood rabble.
Really nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they nailed, they did so many movies, like I said, 24 of them together over the span of 30 years. It's kind of hard to nail down a style. I mean, they had a run of World War II films. Pressburger actually won an Oscar for Best Story for the 49th Parallel. And that was the first of a run of World War II films, most of which were kind of Hitchcockian thrillers. But I think if you had to nail down an aesthetic for them, their overriding aesthetic is what I would call the lavish, opulent, mid-century Technicolor extravaganza. And I am a sucker for lush Technicolor extravaganzas. I want to live in like a Technicolor world if I could. So that's why I think attracted to them. Well, if you want to start with one film of theirs, I would definitely start with what I also would argue is the best, and it's pretty consensus. It's The Red Shoes. It's one of those movies that shows up on those best of lists and everything. This stars Mara Shear as a talented young ballerina who is forced by the draconian head of a ballet company to choose between her career in her art and love. Basically, she falls in love with the composer.
The conductor.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful movie. I mean, this movie just glows on the screen. I mean, it is, the entire thing looks like that shot in The Wizard of Oz where the ruby slippers are sparkling. Like that was the aesthetic for this entire movie, basically. And it's just a beautiful film. Like I said, it just glows and it has all these very stuffy, you know, mid-century British, you know, upper crust trappings, but it's really kind of, for all of that beauty and all that kind of stilted dialogue, it's kind of a dark fable about creative drive, and it's just, it's, I can't say enough about it. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful movie. And as we were talking about before we started recording, this is one of those movies that always kind of like strike. What strikes me is about, it reminds me of like the possibilities of cinema, because, you know, this was 1948. This was, Britain was recovering from the Blitzkrieg. World War II had just happened. You know, all of this kind of stuff going on. Film noir, gritty, like neorealism were kind of in full bloom all around the world. And here comes this lavish Technicolor extravaganza about, you know, wealthy people making art and doomed love, and it just, you know, the world can hold all of that stuff at one time, you know what I mean? And it was just, I don't know, my love for this movie knows no bounds, and if I don't shut up now, I'll probably talk for another hour about it, so I'll let y'all interject.
Party game for a re-listen. Take a shot every time Joey says the word extravaganza.
I'm going to say it a few times in this segment, definitely.
Well, it definitely was. I think that it's an apt word for the description because it's lush and vivid and just, but then the subject matter is, as you said, you got the social elite and you should hate these people, but you don't. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know. It's a great film. I thought it was
and
quite lovely.
There's also a very trippy dance scene, like a set piece, which is clearly inspired by like German expressionism. Which is one of the most memorable scenes in the film. I believe so, yes.
The funeral scene. It reminded me of, remember in Beetlejuice when, what's-her-face's character had to marry Beetlejuice, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, like, the wedding scene just kind of erupts from the ground.
Yep.
Yeah.
That set piece looks so similar in mm-hmm. my mind to that funeral scene. It's so bizarre.
Yeah. So that's to me, that kind of, like, sort of weird, like, German expressionist touch in the middle of this. Otherwise, on the surface, very staid, you know, staged, sort of, you know, opulent Technicolor extravaganza, Todd, kind of puts it over the edge. And again, it's just a great movie. It's definitely their best. I would argue probably also the good starting point, probably the most typical of their films, like the platonic ideal of their aesthetic. And there's a notable movie before I get to what I consider to be, I don't want to call it their worst, but for the purposes of this podcast, there's a notable one before we get there. This is a film that goes by the title Hour of Glory or The Small Back Room. I think Hour of Glory was the U.S. title, and it was released elsewhere.
Was that a small film back room discovered after they both died?
It was not. It was not. And it's kind of like, it's notable because it's the opposite of their normal aesthetic. This is not a huge opulent Technicolor extravaganza. Mm-hmm. This is a, you know, tense, gritty little black and white drama about an alcoholic weapon scientist and just all around miserable bastard who is trying to figure out how the Germans are dropping these booby trapped bombs on Great Britain. And it's not a great movie, certainly not their best, but it is interesting in that they kind of went 180 degrees away from their wheelhouse for it.
Yeah. You know? Well, speaking of that, I do want to add in, when Michael Powell broke away and went solo, he did a notable movie that actually kind of ruined his career at the time, but now is considered to be sort of an influential classic, which is it came out the same year as Psycho, and it got compared to Psycho a bunch, which is Peeping Tom.
Yeah.
So if you've never seen Peeping Tom, that's Michael Powell of those. So a lot of people don't know that that's him.
I don't think that doesn't really put that together.
Right. It doesn't fit in with their aesthetic. Hmm. And, you know, it ended up being a highly controversial, one of the first movies along with Psycho that kind of delved into the sort of seedy serial killer sort of mindset. And it's a great film, but he kind of wasn't able to do much after that.
Was it too lurid?
Oh, absolutely.
And if we want to talk about one other movie here, and again, they've made a shit ton of movies. I think there's 24 of them, and so I have not seen every single one of them. I've seen a good many of
them. Shame on you.
If you gave me, you know, 6 months to prepare for the podcast, I would have done due diligence. But of the ones that I've seen, I have one, and again, worst is not the right.
Yeah, their lowest rated here. Film is like a 74 on mm-hmm. Rotten Tomatoes.
And this one is going to shock some people who might be fans of Powell and Pressburger, because this is considered by a lot of folks to be one of their best movies. And in fact, if you look up, you know, Powell and Pressburger's films ranked, you'll see several, you know, reputable outlets have this ranked number one, and it's Black Narcissus.
Oh, wow.
And I actually agree with you. Of the films of theirs I've seen, this is one I like the least. We watched it together, but continue.
Yeah, it's about a group. It's very much in the Technicolor extravaganza mold. But it is about a group of nuns, British nuns, trying to open up a convent in very, very remote village in India. And it's not a bad film by any stretch of imagination.
Not at all.
And it's beautiful to look at. And there's one scene in particular where I don't know exactly how they did this. I'm assuming they did it with oil paintings,
like matte paintings in the background.
But there's a cliff scene.
I know the shot, yeah, that you're talking about.
That it's shot amazing. Is what attracted me to want to see the movie, mm-hmm. and it's amazing. The movie itself doesn't exactly age all that well for all the reasons that you might think a movie about a bunch of British nuns trying to open a convent
kind of falls into
in India.
Nunsploitation. trap is issues I have.
You say
it.
A trap? I love the Dunfoytations, hey, John, and it's coming back, by the way.
Yeah, but it just doesn't, for whatever reason, doesn't really land for me. And again, not a great film.
I agree, though, with that one.
Yeah. Not a bad film, and a lot of people argue that it's great, but I had trouble connecting with
it's
this one.
It's beautiful to look at. I just didn't connect with the narrative. I didn't, you know. It just didn't. You mentioned non-sploitation, you know, give me Demonia any day of the week, the Italian non-sploitation.
Well, this movie's too, it's too tame. Black Narcissus is too tame. It flirts with that kind of stuff, and it wants to do like this Heart of Darkness kind of thing with, you know, the European soul, you know, corrupted by, you know, natives thing, but it just it's afraid to be dark enough to do
I think that's the best way. It didn't have the courage of its own convictions. I think it was trying to get the viewer to look at sort of the underbelly of some of those establishments, but it didn't want to get too dark.
Yeah, I should probably give it a rewatch to
yeah, same. I mean, yeah. You know, there's probably some cinephile out there shaking their fists at us as they listen to this.
All right, Todd, I think you're up next.
All right. I'm going to start with a directing duo who a lot of our listeners maybe haven't heard of. I hope they have, but if they haven't, you should seek them out. Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. So if those names don't mean anything to you, it's because they have a very do-it-yourself aesthetic. But if you do know who they are, it's because you probably have Shudder or one of those streaming services where you would have seen their sci-fi slash horror films, low budget as hell. I wanted to do them after having seen two of their films, one called Spring and the other called The Endless, and it gave me an opportunity to kind of delve into them further. I like both films a lot. Just to give you a little bit of background about who these two guys are, Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, they both were interns at Ridley Scott's, had kind of a commercial studio, and they were both interns there. And they actually met on Benson's last day. He was actually about to go to medical school. And they met, started chatting, and just really hit it off and realized they had a lot of things in common. And so then they just decided to kind of try to make a movie. And they did it out of their pocket, their first film, which ended up being part of what became a trilogy, which I didn't know. So The Endless that I mentioned before is actually, and I didn't know this when I first saw it, is the middle of three films that are all set in the same universe. Now, they're not sequels, so you don't necessarily have to watch them. And of course, as I say, The Endless, I had no idea that it was connected to their first film.
Resolution.
Resolution, yes. But then after this week, I watched them all in order. I had as much as I liked The Endless before, I was like, holy shit, this is like even better than I thought. The you know, interconnection that they were able to build into that. I want to focus on their three films that are in this universe that I'm talking about for the sake of time. And the first one of those is Resolution. And they made this motherfucker for $20,000 out of their own pockets. And it has a sci-fi-ish element to it, which you would think, like, how are you going to make that for 20 grand? Well, and I think the secret to the sauce of these guys is that they focus on characters and dialogue, and that's how they draw you in. And the premise of Resolution is that this guy who's doing pretty well, he and his wife are about to have a baby. He has this best friend from college who is a crack addict, and he gets sent this film. He assumes from the friend, we later find out that's not necessarily the case, of him doing just crazy, you know, deluded shit that you would imagine someone on crack. And they mentioned meth, too, so I guess it was both of them. on a lot of drugs. But in any case, he hatches this plan. He doesn't tell his wife about it in full, to go out and confront him and try to convince him to go to rehab. The way that he does this is when he confronts him, of course, the friend refuses to go to rehab. And he's like, all right, fine, goes to shake his hand, and then handcuffs him to a radiator in this building that he assumes belongs to the friend. a lot of the movie is just these two guys interacting with one another and hashing out their old shit and reliving their lives and this kind of thing and talking about how they ended up where they are and who's a hypocrite and who's not. And in the meantime, in the background, these weird little things keep happening. There's this UFO cult in the area that the clean friend runs into at one point. That becomes important later in a later film. There's this archaeologist who lives in an RV who was there to study some cave art that he had found there. And he ended up staying there for 30 years by himself. And there's kind of a cool scene between him and the friend. There are two fellow drug addicts of the friend who's handcuffed, who he owes them some dope. Not money, dope. And he doesn't have it, of course, because drug addicts don't save dope, typically, in my experience. And so they want to get their dope. And then another element, and this all sounds convoluted, but it ends up working really well. It turns out that they're not actually staying in an abandoned house. It belongs to these Indians. They're on an Indian reservation, and the Indians come out pissed off as hell, wanting to. And so he has to, you know, offer to. You know, he's like, listen, let me just stay here for a few days to get my friend. You know, gives them some money, etc. Okay, so there's all this shit going on in this area. As convoluted as that sounds, it ends up making sense as the movie goes on because a lot of the film, in addition to the friendship between these two guys playing out on screen, is the place. This place becomes super important. There's some weird shit going on in this specific place that attracts weirdos. And okay, so I could go on and on about this movie, but essentially, and I'm going to give spoilers here because I don't know how else to talk about this trilogy without giving some. So if you want to watch these movies and not know what happens, tune out. But basically what ends up happening is as the movie progresses, these weird films keep showing up that initially they just think someone's fucking with them. Is it the UFO people? The drug addict thinks it's his friend trying to get him to, you know, scare him straight or whatever. And in all of these videos are images of people doing really weird things. And then eventually when you realize that, oh shit, what's going on here, is they see themselves on the video doing things they haven't done yet. And then they're like, what the fuck? So what it turns out is happening is they're kind of seeing things happening. It's not in the future. It's possibilities of things that could happen. And so what the hell's going on? So long story short, these aren't future happenings. Once they see these potential future happenings, they're like, okay, let's avoid this. Let's get out of here. The two drug addicts are going to come and kill us. Okay, well, let's leave. So what it turns out is that this place, there's some entity there that they think, their explanation for it is it wants to see a narrative with an ending that satisfies it. And so the way the film ends is in a, I'm not going to give too much away, but it's a positive ending, you think, and then the entity kind of comes in and they're like, we can do it again. And then the movie's over.
Todd doesn't want to give anything away, but he just told you exactly what happens in the movie, beat for beat.
Well, I didn't. No, it seems like a metaphor for the movie viewer. Now wait a minute. I didn't go into that many specifics. All right, now so I'm gonna have to move on to the second movie.
Oh my gosh! Okay.
Okay. Sorry, there's no way to do, Sean. I'm sorry. There's no way to do the show except for us to go on on the pulpit. But anyway, The Endless. This is my favorite of theirs. So to get to that part. Which I had seen before this movie years ago, and I loved it. Well,
this is the one that focuses on the UFO cult.
Yes.
It focuses. Yes. So the UFO cult, the two directors play the UFO cult members, but it's a cameo in the first movie, and there's not much. They're just part of the weird scene that's going on in this area. So The Endless focuses on that group. What happens is those two characters, 10 years in the past of the film, left the UFO cult. The older brother, played by Benson, one of the directors, and then Moorhead plays the younger brother, wanted to get his younger brother out of there, and the story that he told was that they were going to all do like a mass suicide, and all the men were castrated and all this stuff. Well, his little brother has been miserable in real life, in the life that he's taken them into, and so he wants to go visit this place, which the older brother's like, no, we can't do it. But finally he gives in and is like, we're going to go visit. And they go visit. And before too long, you start to see that actually there's something to this cult. There's a scene where this guy's doing magic tricks. He's like, let me show you this one. He throws a baseball into the air. It doesn't come back down. And then he makes the older brother hold his hand out. It lands in his hand. And so all this, there's like something to all this. Now, where it connects with the later film is in the middle, all of a sudden, all this stuff that references the other movie starts coming in. And in fact, the wife of the guy who ends up going missing at the end of the film is in the UFO cult now simply because she wants to find her husband. And then eventually we end up visiting these two guys. And what we find out is, and again, a spoiler alert, but this area has these time loops that people get caught in. Mm-hmm. And some of the time loops are longer and shorter than others. There's this one creepy-ass time loop of a guy from the Civil War era who it's like 5 seconds. And so this guy is just stuck in, he's in his tent, and he's stuck in this loop that happens over and over again, 5 seconds at a time. Other loops are longer than others. So anyway, the movie's really cool. I'm going to stop there. I know I'm taking up too much time. I'm going to go on to the third movie, which is my least favorite of theirs, to get to that, which is Synchronic is the name of the third one. This one is less connected to the other two.
That's a Lost Dr. Dre album, yeah. Too.
This one has it's set in a city. So these other two films were both set in the area in which the film took place. So Synchronic, what it turns out that it is this synthetic drug that comes, that the plant that they base the synthetic drug off of comes from this area that those guys hung out in. It focuses on these two EMTs who are buddies, and I liked the first half of the movie a lot. That, again, I think the bread and butter and the strength of these two directors is when they have characters interacting with each other, and it's really about their relationships as much as anything else. Where this movie lost me a little bit was, so what starts happening is the people who are taking this synthetic drug, the younger they are, if they're young, they disappear. Just vanish. Well, it turns out that they're like going back into time or something. And this is where the movie kind of lost me, because I thought what they did really well in the other two movies, they didn't over-explain. And in this one, there's whole scenes where they're like trying to explain what's going on and figure. And that's where it wasn't interesting to me. There's one part of the movie where one of the characters is by himself for a lot of the time because he's trying to figure out what's going on. And I found that less interesting than just the parts where they're interacting. So I'll leave it at that. But that's why I didn't like that one quite as much as the others. However, it has its merits. And one thing, and I'll leave you with this, that as their do-it-yourself aesthetic, what they're brilliant at in using their limited budgets are a couple things. One, the way in which they don't have crappy CGI effects in there. They create scenarios where they can just let the viewer use their imagination. And then they also, and then when they do,
it seems like a lot of stuff in The Endless happens off camera. It's like a lot of the sci-fi elements happen off camera.
Exactly. And the scores are very unsettling. They're sparse. They're self-contained, but they're very unsettling, and it really works well for the genre.
All right, I'm going to be brief on mine. I'm talking about The Daniels because their filmography is very short, consisting of two feature-length films together. Daniel Kwan, Daniel Scheinert, collectively known as The Daniels. They began their career as directors of music videos, including ones for Houdini by Foster the People and Turned Down for What by DJ Snake and Lil Jon. Both of which earned them nominations for the Grammy Awards. If you haven't seen either one of those and you've seen these other films of theirs, you should go look at their videos, because they use their music videos as kind of a proving ground for things that they will later employ in their movies.
I don't think I've seen the
Turn Down for What looks like the fight scenes in Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh, wow.
It's great connective tissue. So, getting into the film, Swiss Army Man 2016, of course, was the film with
Daniel Radcliffe
and Paul Dano. And it's a surrealist, kind of quirky, indie feeling kind of flick that's just weird. But it does carry a lot of the same tone that Everything Everywhere All at Once carries. A lot of the same touchstones in terms of sympathy and cuteness and family and loneliness and all those weird crunchy emotions that we all have to deal with. That's a common theme in their work. Also, their ability to montage is really good. And they even make a joke about it in Swiss Army Man about the montage. All it took was a montage. But they do montages very well.
That movie is so singularly weird.
Yeah.
That I think we talked about this when you mentioned you were watching it. I've seen that movie, and every time that someone mentions it, I think about it for the first time ever. It leaves my memory because it's so weird. Yeah. I don't have a place to file it.
They were scheduled to do a TV adaptation of Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut, but that was not picked up.
Ooh.
A little difficult.
Unfilmable.
Yeah. Pertinent to this episode, there's a cool interview with South by Southwest with the Daniels. And I'm going to paraphrase a quote from Daniel Kwan. He says, "I think the fact that we're a duo really helps be inventive directors. There are often a lot of directorial duos. Lord and Miller, they're great. The Coen brothers, constantly experimenting with genres and new ways of making movies." Scheinert jumps in and says, "Yeah, and if you look at solo directors, they're all bad." Then Kwan jumps back in. He says, "It's about having the courage to make these movies together. Things that I would never do alone." And I can see that is like when you have a friend to kind of lean on and bounce ideas off of.
And call you on your bullshit too.
And then they say, you know, how do you get past disagreements being a duo? And he said, it's the rule of thumb is whoever cares the most wins. And if they both care equally about it, then obviously that's not the problem. It's something else. And so that it really helps them work out some of their decision-making processes. That's the Daniels. They're up and comers. I mean, obviously they hit it out of the park on the second try. I mean, how much better do you need to be? So I'm excited to see the work that they continue to churn out. All right, so we're going to jump into intermission so we can all go relieve ourselves in the yard, but not before we say,
let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Get ourselves some
Twix.
Twix, yeah. They come in pairs. Yeah, that's a good job.
Yum, yum. It's time for a tasty and refreshing snack. We promise to satisfy your hunger, your thirst, your sweet tooth. So visit our refreshment center now. Let's go!
Well, we're back. We peed in the yard, and except Joey. Joey's holding it in for some reason, weirdo. All right.
Bladder of steel.
Yes. All right, so let's jump into the second half and go at it with our other directorial duos. Is it directorial or directorial?
Directorial.
Directorial duos. All right, Joey, you're up.
So, much like Sean's duo, the Daniels, my duo started out directing videos. R.E.M., Smashing Pumpkins, etc. Some Pointed for Pyros. I think a Raging as Machine videos. Basically, if it was, you know, a buzzbin band in the 90s, they probably directed a video for it. My video is Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Ferris. They are a married couple. This is kind of sweet. They're sort of like the antithesis of the Hollywood marriage. They met in college. They're still together. They have three kids. So I can't imagine working on creative projects with my wife and still remaining married. We would kill each other. So they only have three feature films. The reason I chose this is because one of those films is one of my absolute just comfort food movies. We talked about the One and Done on the One and Done episode. I don't rewatch a great many movies. This is one though that sometimes I just put on in those comfort food movie situations, and it's Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah.
From 2006. I love that movie.
Yeah, I love that movie too.
It's about a wannabe life coach played by Greg Kinnear, who packs up for a road trip with his wife, played by Toni Collette.
The brilliant Toni Collette in anything she's in.
Yeah, her brother Frank, Steve Carell, their emo teenager, Paul Dano. And
yeah, it was like probably the first Dano. Dano pops up, probably one of the first things he was in.
That's probably, I was going to say, probably had to be one of his first roles. And then their crotchety father, Alan Arkin, who just steals the fucking movie.
Rest in peace.
And they pack up on a road trip across the Southwest to take their daughter Olive, who is a chubby kind of preteen girl, to a beauty pageant where they know she is going to be out of place, it's a big thing with the film. Leads up to what I think is the best dance number in cinematic history, and it just lampoons the very idea of like preteen
sexy teen.
God,
sexy preteen.
It's so cringy, and the satire just works. And
other
it's just
than Elizabeth
funny.
Berkeley's lap dance and Showgirls, but
this one's better.
She was of age though.
It's just a great little tragicomic movie. You laugh, you cry, you laugh again. I don't have a whole lot else to say about it except it's fucking great. You guys agree, right?
The thing I love about that movie is Greg Kinnear's character, because he's trying to get into the self-help business but can't. He's trying to sell his self-help book. And so he's got this positivity that he's trying to infuse in everybody. That's why they end up, you know, taking the daughter to this pageant. Everyone else is kind of like, all right, man, you know.
I always assume that people who are self-help gurus are projecting because their lives are falling apart in real life, and this is very much that. They have only three movies. The one I'm going to say for the middle movie is The Battle of the Sexes, about the 1970s tennis battle between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. Yep.
Have either of y'all seen that? Did you watch it?
I watched it today. It's okay. It's pretty good. It's not great.
Emma Stone played Billie Jean King?
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought the choice was odd. Yeah.
It's for me, it was kind of a one joke movie. Once you kind of get used
to Bobby Riggs,
Steve Carell.
Okay.
Carell does a fine job, but once you kind of get used to this like kind of over the top chauvinist grifter character, it's kind of a one joke movie, and it doesn't really know if it wants to be a comedy.
It could have been a short.
Yeah. It doesn't really want to know if it wants to be a full-blown comedy or like a historical fiction pick. It doesn't. It has its moments, but it doesn't really work. I'm going to argue, though, that their worst movie, again, is not bad. And I actually quite like this movie, but there's one thing about it that, for me, just is a sticking point. This is Ruby Sparks. This was the movie they did after Little Miss Sunshine. Paul Dano, again. He plays a writer who hit it big as like a teenage phenom with a New York Times bestseller, and he's struggling creatively, he's struggling in his romantic life, and he finds one day that a character that he's writing, which is sort of like his fantasy woman, has come to flesh and blood life in his house.
He ripped off a Twilight Zone episode.
And it's, you're right, but what I was going to say is that when I say he's writing his fantasy woman, this doesn't come across like weird science. It's a much more twee version of that. She's like a very, you know, cute.
Yes, I've seen that movie.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a lot better than that premise of, you know, writer's creation comes to life. It's a lot better than that premise would have you believe. But there's one thing about it that just sticks in my craw, and it's the very last scene. I won't give too much away for anybody who still hasn't seen this movie, but suffice it to say that the ending, the very last scene, seems to me to be tacked on. It's almost as if the studio is tapping the directors on the shoulder and saying, hey, wait, remember, this is a romantic comedy, not a dark fable about fantasy and twisted controlling relationships. And that, to me, just kind of... I'm not going to say it's a fatal flaw, because, again, I quite enjoy this movie and I like it, but it is a sticking point, so that's why I nominated it for the worst.
A producer came over and tapped them on the shoulder and said, hey, You can't do an episode about great duos without doing Joel and Ethan Coen. Joel being the older brother by about 3 years of Ethan. One thing I thought was interesting that I found as I was looking into this that I wasn't aware of is that up until The Lady Killers, which came out in 2004, Joel was always listed as the sole director and Ethan as a producer. And I found out the reason for that was, at least at the time that they started making movies, the union didn't want there to be two directors listed on a film because they were worried that that would encourage producers to, you know, look for shortcuts in terms of what they paid paid people. I guess the reason after 2004 that they could start doing that or putting their names together was because if you're an established duo, they made an exception for that. So I don't know if that still exists. I assume not, because the duo I mentioned previously are both mentioned as directors. But anyway, I thought that was a little interesting as I started looking at that. But their first film came out in 1983, which was Blood Simple, noir film. And one thing that that established early on about them with their aesthetic is they're usually riffing off of two types of genres, either or and or the noir and the Western. Those are usually both playing into their films. There are a couple of exceptions, and that's maybe where they go astray a little bit at times, but that's very often usually plays some sort of factor in most of their films, if you think about it. And I defy you to find many exceptions where those elements aren't in there. So they have a wide filmography. I haven't seen all the movies, although I've seen most of them. And so I had a little bit of difficulty picking. I had a little bit of difficulty picking what one that I didn't like was, because the ones I've seen, I've liked them all. The two that seem to be get mixed opinions among the fan base the most were Back to Back, 2003 Intolerable Cruelty, and 2004 The Lady Killers. I didn't see those for that reason. I was like, well,
both of those, and I'm a big Coen Brothers fan, and those are two of the weaker Coen Brothers movies. Mm-hmm. But Lady Killers to me feels like it's trying to be a Coen Brothers movie. It's a remake of an earlier movie from the 50s, I believe.
Yep.
But it feels
no, The Lady
like
Killers is actually the one that it was remaking was actually considered a classic British film.
I think there's two things. One, it feels like it's trying to be Coens by the numbers, like they kind of got stuck in a rut. And then, Tom Hanks's energy just doesn't blend well with that Coen Brothers aesthetic.
And I can see that. Yeah.
And Intolerable Cruelty to me feels like the Coen Brothers trying to cash in on like a huge blockbuster type movie. And again, I like both of them, but mm-hmm. they're two of the weaker.
And
ones.
I would also argue that Clooney is similar to Hanks, even though Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was great. I think that was almost a fluke performance by him, because I think in general he doesn't really fit the energy mm-hmm. either like Hanks. He did do very well in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, though, with that character. Okay, so I'm going to start with the one, though, that I ended up picking for the worst, because so here's how I had to break it down. Of course, I eliminated the films that I hadn't seen, which I just mentioned a couple of them. I have not seen Hail Caesar from 2016. It sounds like people don't like that one that much either. And then I've never seen the Hudsucker Proxy. I have not seen that, 1994.
Critics hated it. I loved it.
Okay.
Me too.
I hadn't seen that. So the standard, I was racking my brain. How am I going to do this? So I was like, all right, I'm going to pick the ones I've only seen once. And there actually aren't that many that I've only seen once. So there were three or four. Inside Llewyn Davis was one of them, which
great.
I really like.
Love that movie.
So that's not going to be the pick. True Grit, which I like pretty well. I'm a big fan of the author of that novel, Charles Portis, and I appreciated that they tried to make it truer to his vision than the John Wayne version. That one wasn't the one I picked either. And then the other one that I did pick is, again, I'm going to have to qualify this, a movie that I like, But nevertheless, I mean, I'm going to just have to pick it as The Man Who Wasn't There, which I like it. I mean, look, I don't blame you for it's a noir-esque. It's shot in black and white. Beautifully done. It stars Billy Bob Thornton with Frances McDormand. Scarlett Johansson's in it. Tony Shalhoub. James Gandolfini is in it. It's set in 1949 Santa Rosa, California. It's a very much a noir aesthetic. And this one isn't like... this one, they really get into the noir stuff rather than it being just something they're doing a genre-bending thing with. And I guess that's maybe why I didn't like it as much as some of the others, is that I felt like of all their movies that I've seen, that was the one that was more by the numbers of the genre that it was working in, rather than them kind of blending things together and making it their own thing. Now, I'm not saying they didn't have their own little touches there. Again, I liked the movie. And so it was like, trying to pick the worst looking gold piece out of the treasure chest.
What we all want to know is, what's your number one? What's your best Coen Brothers
movie? Okay, so now that I've established
there's
that.
There's a right answer here, by the way.
Well, so here's the thing. There were multiple contenders. And so I just had, here's how I decided. So I'll mention a couple of contenders first. One of them, a lot of people probably wouldn't think of, but that I think is one of their best, is A Serious Man from 2009. I think that's one of their best, frankly. That's the one with the Jewish professor who basically becomes Job. And a student accuses him of, being a racist, his wife leaves him for this creepy guy, etc. Anyway, that was one of the contenders. And then the one though, Fargo was a contender. I mean, I love Blood Simple. So many good ones. I ended up settling on, I did the same standard.
It's gotta
like,
be Lebowski, right?
Yes. Okay. Lebowski. I had to. I felt like I was being basic bitch and doing that, but come on, it's the one I've seen the most. I watched it when I was in L.A. recently because it's an L.A. film and I wanted to, like, live out the scenes, you know. They go to an In-N-Out Burger, et cetera. And it's the most quotable film. It's the most rewatchable film. So many people, including me, can just, like, recite lines off the top of their head. It's
the most important movie of our times.
Yeah, it's another one that builds off the noir element, but it's a combination of noir and Western because you have the dude ends up becoming an investigator unwillingly because they peed on his fucking rug. But then you also have Sam Elliott in a memorable role coming in as the narrator, which I thought was a brilliant little touch there. And the thing that I love about this movie is that there are no inconsequential characters. Anybody that's on the film, even if it's just for a couple of minutes, has a memorable part. Take, for example, the dude, his car gets stolen, so he calls a couple of cops over. Those guys are on there for 2 minutes. I remember the lines from those guys. I wouldn't hold out much hope for the tape deck, though, or the credence.
You know? Even Flea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or the guy that finds his car, you know, the cop that finds his car, he's in there probably for 45 seconds. So, man, are there any leads on who stole the car? Leads? I don't know, man. We'll call everybody that down at the crime lab and see. Leads. You know, I mean, every character is just distinct, memorable. There are no, you know. So, is that movie the deepest movie of all time in terms of what's going on? No, of course. No, but I mean, in terms of the writing, in terms of the characters... in terms of you're laughing, every 5 seconds, the hardest that I've ever laughed in my life was the first time that I watched The Big Lebowski, and after one of the characters dies and they have his ashes in a Folgers crystals jar because the most modestly priced receptacle was too expensive for them. Walter Subcheck, played by the great John Goodman, who's a genius in this, gives a speech, starts dumping out the ashes into the ocean in Malibu, and the ashes fly into the face of the dude. And the dude just stands there with the ashes flying in his face. I
that
never laughed
on,
so hard in my life.
That look on his face when that happens, and everybody can, I can relate to this. Everybody has that friend who is just too much business, and
And Walter always bringing up Vietnam, and the dude's like, "What the fuck does that have to do with Vietnam?"
When the ashes blow back onto his face, yeah. And the look, yeah.
He just stands stone still. And then my favorite part of that moment, though, is the last gesture that Walter makes before he realizes that he, got the ashes in his face. He taps the Folgers crystals jar one final time to get the last little bit out. I'm guessing most of our listeners have seen this movie, but that's got to be my favorite. It's the one I've seen the most. This is
a whole other episode, but we should do a ranking of Coen Brothers films.
A bracket
episode. I was gonna accept Lebowski or Miller's Crossing as the best. My worst, yeah. While we're at it, and you can edit this out if you need to, but it was Burn After Reading. That's my worst. Mm.
That's another one. I didn't mention that one's one I hadn't seen. But I the ones that people were like lukewarm about, I just didn't bother to go and watch. I guess I hadn't gone on a trip.
So no mention of Raising Arizona.
I love Son. You got a panty on your head.
That's in the top five.
No mention. No mention of Barton Fink.
I love Barton Fink. Jeez, yeah, man. I mean. Listen, well, you know, that's what I'm saying.
For Barton Fink being my favorite.
They're both.
Well, I mean, as a writer, of course, there's a representation of William Faulkner in the movie.
I think that Raising Arizona.
John Goodman's best role.
Raising Arizona and Barton Fink are like two great American art films.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you break them down according to like just what makes an art film, those two movies hit it note for note for note for note.
I would not argue anyone who picked either of those films as their favorite. That was the trouble with Coen. Like I said, with the Coen brothers, like, you're going to pick a worse?
Most of them are very, very good, and all of them are at least watchable. Even Lady Killers, even Burn After Reading, which is my worst, is not a terrible movie.
Well, I would argue that if you want to like find Shakespeare in screenwriting, it's that combination, because their dialogue is just absolutely sublime in pretty much every movie. Even the ones that aren't that great, it's like there's memorable lines.
All right, it's my turn to bring us down from these lofty heights. I'm going to be talking about another brother duo, the Farrelly brothers. Peter Farrelly and Bobby Farrelly, collectively 90s Farrelly, known as the Farrelly brothers. They've made 11 films together. They're from Cumberland, Rhode Island, and of Irish descent. Following college, they pursued careers as television writers, notably for Seinfeld. And I'm going to mention that again in a little bit. So each of their first four films, Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and There's Something About Mary, and Me, Myself, and Irene, had a plot centering around a road trip.
Wait,
their first three movies are bam, bam, bam.
I know.
I mean,
people talk about the best four album runs in rock and roll history. When it comes to like gross out comedy, kind of like murderer's row.
My dad
man.
Took me to see Dumb and Dumber when I was 13, and anybody who knows my dad. That is not his style of humor, and he was cracking up with Dumb and Dumber.
So those trips all originate in Rhode Island, except for Kingpin, which begins in Pennsylvania for obvious reasons. Their films frequently use slapstick comedy and toilet humor, and they're populated with blunt, profane, working-class characters in small roles. Many of the films contain flashback scenes that show how a character was affected by a traumatic event. That's another strange...
That's a trope in there.
Trope. It's just weird. They're also noted for their soundtracks, typically featuring distinct current selections as well as some classic stuff, power pop and folk rock. Interestingly enough, the brothers have now started doing things separately, and it's odd because separate work is completely off the beaten path. 2018, Peter directs Green Book and wins Best Picture.
Whoa. Okay. I did not realize that he did. Oh, wow.
Yep. Then in 2022, he turns around and does The Greatest Beer Run Ever, which wasn't a terrible movie. 23, Bobby does Champions, and then Peter's back to his old ways with Ricky Stenicki in 2024.
So. And people did lump Green Book, though, in with like a Crash from 2005 as
I agree. All right. So the best film can arguably be, I think Dumb and Dumber is up there, but for me, I've never laughed so hard as There's Something About Mary.
Yes. I think that's actually goes beyond just the toilet humor, because I think there's actually some you know.
There's some good stuff in the film. I rewatched it. This would have been my third viewing. And yes, the laughs definitely fall off after your first viewing because there is such a shock of some of that comedy.
With the scene, the zipper scene.
Oh, just the cringiness of it all. There are things about the film, obviously, that do not age well.
When he, I still laugh at it. I'm sorry.
When he opens the door and there's Cum in his hair.
Or in Carmen Diaz's
We've hair. All been there, so yeah.
Cameron Diaz.
Because his his buddy was like, hey, you got to rub one out before you go on a date.
And Cameron Diaz was adorable in this film. Oh, and her THOs on full display in every costume she wore. You mentioned Chris Elliott. Thank you.
And then Woogie.
And then Matt Dillon with his god awful
Matt
tooth prosthetic, slimy,
Matt
skeezy.
Matt Dillon as Matt Healy wins my award for that film. I loved that character. He was sublime.
And then of course Lynn Shay playing Magda, the neighbor, the old leathery Miami classic neighbor. She appears in the other movie I'm about to talk about. But yeah. Fun movie. Things that didn't age well. The Brett Favre appearance.
Yep. Yeah. Can't use the R word anymore.
Well, you can't do that. That was even talked about there, though. They pointed out that you shouldn't say that. But Brett Favre. His cameo in a movie where it's the funniest movie about stalking ever made. Yeah. And you know, Favre being the guy that's cheated on his wife with a newscaster in Green Bay. That's why he got out. And then, of course, where did the story go about him taking the money that was supposedly earmarked for welfare recipients in Mississippi?
I think he sent a bunch of dick pics, too, like his masseuse.
Oh, the dick pics? Yeah, yeah.
That was when he was with the Jets.
The welfare fraud thing.
So the Brett Favre appearance was not
the fact that he's like the perfect boyfriend. In this movie.
Better than OJ's appearances in Naked Gun, as we were talking about earlier.
All right, so their worst movie, that's a tough decision, but I think I'm going to go with the one that was, the critics agreed, The Three Stooges. It was one of those movies.
I've never even saw it. It just sounds
like
it's
one of those movies
idea.
Where everyone just kind of scratched their heads, and they're like, how did this movie get made? Why? Who wants this movie to be made? I watched this movie for the first time in the last couple of weeks, and I've got to say, it's not as bad as I was led to believe, but again, it was, as I said to Joey before the show, it's kind of like the Baywatch movie. If it's an adaptation of something so thin, what did you expect? It's a Depression-era slapstick comedy short featuring three imbeciles who hate each other.
That's the irony of the fact that they tried to make a full-length movie of this is that the Three Stooges were at their best in shorts.
Yeah. Well, what I did like about the movie, and I thought was clever, is each of the acts of the film are introduced as episodes. They have title cards just like the old things. And you know, I think that Will Sasso does a great job as Curly. I think Sean Hayes did a pretty decent job as Larry. And then the guy who played Mo was Chris. I'm going to butcher this Greek name. Diamantopoulos, but a crazy cast of supporting characters. The reason to watch this movie is, again, they wrote for Seinfeld. Larry David as a nun.
Okay. I don't remember that.
Throughout the film, it's Larry fucking David as a nun. That's worth the price of admission. Jane Lynch is in it. Jennifer Hudson, Kate Upton, Skylar Gisondo, who, if you watch The Righteous Gemstones, he's the oldest son of The Righteous Gemstones. He plays young Mo in a flashback sequence. It's pretty funny.
I remember when I watched this movie, when I rented it, I thought that it was going to be like a biopic.
It would have done, but should have been a biopic, but no, they went for the straight-up original story. Jersey Shore appears in it. It's a plot point. Mo becomes a cast member on Jersey Shore, which is how he gets the money to save the convent. But
that was poorly conceived. Surely
it's not the convent. I'm sorry, not the orphanage home. I don't want to butcher this pristine plot. Funny, there is a connected callback to the Three Stooges, or a call ahead from Something About Mary. Remember the scene where where Ted is fighting with the dog.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And the dog tries to poke the eyes of the dog, and the dog puts his paw up.
Right.
Yeah. So the Three Stooges. Anyway, I just dragged this all down into, you know, just troglodyte humor. But the Farrelly brothers do deserve the mention because they work well together. They produced a huge body of comedy, good or bad or
their
in between.
Their first three movies great. Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, There's Something About Mary. That's a great run there.
You're disparaging your own picks here, but I'll quote Black Francis from Frank Black at the time. In a song about the Three Stooges, he says, in Three Reelers, he sings, "Some gibberish, it is so serious." And so, you know, there's a time and a place for, like, dumbass humor.
Oh, sure.
And, like, I mean, it makes the world a better place because, you know, laughter heals, man.
Oh, I agree. And it's just, again, it was the head scratcher of why did they make this? It just seems like a strange one to do. A modern take on.
Probably just because of their fanboyness of the
they had the chops to do it, too.
They could pick whatever they wanted
to make, and they did. Much like a comedy, a touching comedy about conjoined twins.
Yeah. Stuck on my side. I remember liking that movie. I saw it in the theaters. I don't
it
know
has,
much about it. I remember laughing and kind of liking it.
It has
Matt Damon.
It has some critical acclaim.
Yeah.
So I didn't watch it because I thought it was kind of tasteless. But
I honestly don't remember that much about it. I remember at the time, though, thinking, oh, that wasn't bad.
All right, that's it for Dynamic Duo Directors. I know we left a lot on the cutting room floor. We didn't talk about several of them, actually. But next episode, guys, I'm reaching back through time and pulling one of the themes from the very first season of Cinema Chop Shop, and we're revisiting samurai movies, not named Seven Samurai, Rashomon, and one other. I'll send it out in the invitation, but we're going to talk about some of the ones that weren't discussed.
I'm down.
And I don't know if it's going to be a which one's the greatest of all time kind of thing, or are we just going to pick the ones that we want to watch?
Ooh, but there's so many of them.
Many. Modern, old, classic, 1970s.
The Shaw Brothers.
Yojimbo, is that?
Yeah.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, there's some great ones in there. So we're going to talk about samurai films. We're going to really dig deep and talk about some of the lesser known ones possibly. There's some cool stuff that I'm excited to dig into on samurai flicks. So we'll be back in a little bit about that. Please check us out on social media. We're Cinema Chop Shop everywhere except for YouTube, in which we are Cinema Chop Shop Podcast, where you can watch an audio presentation of this podcast. Please check us out, tell your friends about us, rate, review, subscribe, and all that good stuff. And in the meantime, please remember to watch, chop, retrofit.